This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women. Might be your next-door neighbor that, if you take the time to talk to them, you're going to be amazed by the stories they have to tell. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated. We're entertained. So many times inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I know that's the case today. I love talking baseball, especially to World War II veterans. And the gentleman today is not only a veteran of World War II, he is as baseball man as you can find. That's a saying I'm sure you've heard a few times, right, George? Yeah. George Genovese, 93 years old, of North Hollywood, California, originally from the New York City area. In your mind, before we get into your past, what's a baseball man? Because I hear that saying a lot. In your mind, what does that mean, to be a baseball man?
Well, it means that in some capacity you love that game and has been able to make a living out of it, whether you be a coach, manager, fortunate enough to play in the big leagues. And, of course, they didn't pay the money that they do now. But if you were able to get to the big leagues even for a day, you figured you got it. Maybe you didn't stay. But your destination, you made it. Even for a day, it's worth the time.
Mm-hmm. And you just listed a few different things, and you filled all those roles. You've been a coach, you've been a manager, you've been a major league player, and you're one of the most legendary scouts in the history of Major League Baseball. And we're going to talk before we're done about some of the players that you signed. And hopefully people will read all about it in your new book with Dan Taylor, A Scout's Report, My 70 Years in Baseball. But let's go back earlier than 70 years. You're 93. Big Italian family. Your parents were immigrants from Naples.
That's right.
What was life like growing up? And was it on Staten Island? Is that where you were?
You know, I was. It was the very depression years back in those days. So you learn to work and earn your own money for a long time. You know.
So you had four older brothers.
Yeah.
Was it their fault you got interested in baseball?
Well, we all played baseball at one time or other. My two older brothers played with the House of David. They had to wear a beard. Now it's a novelty because everybody wears beards now. But in those days, they didn't wear beards, you know, only the House of David team. My oldest brother played for the House of David. When he graduated school, grade school, he went right into learning a trade. He was a machinist, and so he gave up his job with the House of David and got my brother the job because he could play.
Mm-hmm.
And in the wintertime or in the early spring, the House of David would go down. They'd play Pepper for 2 days. And the next day or two, they were playing the major league clubs in spring training, trying to get the major leaguers in shape.
Mm-hmm.
And it was there that my brother Chick scouts on and gave him a little bonus and signed him for the Red Sox. And 3 years in a row, they were in what they call the Little World Series. Now, Branch Rickey was a man that from the Cardinals.
Mm-hmm.
He was wanting to bring in the first black player, right? Well, the World Series, he played at Montreal. He beat my brother's club out with a base hit, won the Little World Series for the Montreal team.
Robinson did.
And that was it.
Uh-huh.
Robinson was the man. And later on, over the years, he gave me my first player manager's job because he thought I had enough talent and asked me if he would take the job. He says, go home. Talk it over with your wife, let me know in the morning. Job is yours if you want it. And that was the start of my scouting career and managing career.
So just as Jackie Robinson felt indebted to Branch Rickey, you feel the same thing with your baseball career.
That's right.
But you almost didn't have a baseball career. You graduated high school, and you were training to be a blacksmith when you got called for a tryout. You're a 5'6" shortstop, and you ditched out on with the fire burning and the coals heating up for some work. You just ran out of there.
I just said, so long. I wanted to be a baseball player. But like anyone in that era, learning a trade was important to hold a job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you had some skill with work, you usually kept your job.
And you were fortunate enough, you were talented enough that the scouts saw something in you. And they signed you to play pro ball. So you're playing professional baseball. Well, I guess it would have been your off season when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. Do you remember that day?
Yeah.
What do you remember?
I came out of church And all of a sudden I put the radio on, and I'm hearing President Roosevelt talk about the Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor. A state of war exists.
Uh-huh.
That was his comment.
What did that mean to you?
You know, you're wondering what's going on. People had signed up because they had to go on the draft.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in my day, we had a big family, so there was always two to the bed, you know, big beds. So my brother got his draft notice, and I didn't even bother. I saw Jim. He had two ribs missing. He was not healthy enough to pass the get a job at the fire department. They said he was not physically fit. The other one was the police department, not physically fit. So he's getting up early because he's got to report to the draft board. And I said, I'll see you when you come back. They're not going to take you. He had two ribs missing. Well, he worked his way all the way up from just a GI. I didn't even want to get up and say goodbye to him. You'll be back. Okay. Well, he had quite a career. He became a first sergeant. I'll never forget, a half a dozen years ago over at UCLA, there was a big baseball tournament going on. I had to go there. My name was called, Mr. Genovese, the lineup is ready. So I had to go to where the scorekeepers were and pick
up.
And I came and sat down. And all of a sudden, this big guy comes over and he taps me on the shoulder. Your name, George Genovese? Yeah. Did you have a brother named Jim? Yeah. He said, put it there, pal. He says, he saved my life, which made me feel great. My brother never had ever said anything about his career in the military, you know. He had never mentioned anything to us because three of us in the family were, my other brother was in the Seabees. The Japanese were up in Alaska. They had to go up there and chase them out. If you remember history, in the Seabees, the construction battalion, Phil Rizzuto was in his outfit.
How about that? So, he couldn't escape those diminutive Italian shortstops, could he?
No.
He had you at home and Rizzuto in Alaska. So a guy whose life your brother saved finds you at UCLA. So you have the two other brothers in the service. But let's go back to early 1942. You're not in the service yet.
No.
You're playing minor league ball in the Carolina League?
That's right, Asheville. There were three of us. We were like the three musketeers. Roland LeBlanc was even rated higher than eventually great player that Stan Musial.
Uh-huh.
I knew him well while we were all in the service there, you know. He was worried about getting released. I said, if I could hit a ball like you, they got to find some place to play you. And my brother was in the Army. I was the first one to ever see him in the Army. It was at Fort McClellan, Alabama. He came over to see me, to surprise me. He had his military clothes on, and I introduced him to Musial. And Musial right away shook his hand and all. I says, you know, this guy is worried about getting released. If I could hit a ball like him, they got to find some place to play him. He was really worried. He became a great star.
Yeah.
So we became great friends. When I got to Washington briefly, we had to play St. Louis Cardinals an exhibition game. He come over and shook my hands. He said, George, I hope you stay up here. I said, I do too.
And this story's in your book. Musial had signed out of high school as a pitcher. You were telling him what a great hitter he was, and you're not the only one who noticed. That was 1941, and later on that season, a 20-year-old Stan the Man Musial would make his major league debut with the Cardinals. We should also note Musial served in the Navy at the tail end of World War II. And you started to tell us about your three musketeers.
So you had LeBlanc.
And he became a B-24 pilot. He fought over there with the Chinooks. They sent him over because the Himalayas were lined up and had to be protected where the Japs couldn't get in there and get a good foothold.
So he became a hump pilot. And you had another friend to make up those three musketeers.
Yeah.
And his story in World War II didn't work out the same way.
No, his name was Frank Zara, and a very good friend of mine. And while I was on the island, I heard he had gotten killed. You know, Same Island, Okinawa. And when the war ended, I went over to the cemetery, and sure enough, I saw his grave. A wonderful guy. We were hanging around, LeBlanc, him, and George Sisler's son. We were all friends and playing ball together. And then we got our draft notice in North Carolina. They lowered the draft from 21 down to 18.
Mm-hmm.
And we all were called the same day. So I asked if I could get permission to finish out the season by going home and reporting to my draft board back home. And they said, okay.
So that's what you did. Before we get into your military story, how good a ball player were you? I mean, before the war? Because this is an interesting plot. You know, I've had people on this show. For instance, Monty Irvin was on this show. And he had been approached about being the first black ball player when he came back from World War II, about being the first black major leaguer. But he was so injured and beat up from the war, he didn't think he'd do justice to African Americans. I've talked to a lot of guys whose baseball careers were impacted by World War II. So before you served, before you got into the Air Corps, how good a ball player were you? What do you think your prospects were?
Well, I thought I could play.
Were you fast?
Yeah, I could play. I could run. I had good hands in the infield. I had a good arm.
You had a strong throwing arm.
Oh, yeah. I did hurt it later on during the war. But
that's what I'm getting at. But before the war, you've got a very strong throwing arm from shortstop.
And I could run.
You could run.
Yeah.
I know it's impossible to say, but if anyone's qualified to speak to a prospect's opportunities to get to the big leagues, it's you. You've scouted guys for a living. If you scouted the 20-year-old George Genovese in Asheville in 1942, is that a guy who's going to be in the big leagues in the next 5 years?
I think so, or more.
Yeah.
I felt I could play.
So you're a prospect, but like everybody else, you had to put those plans on hold and go serve your country. You ended up in the U.S. Army Air Corps, and you would serve in the 557th Air Service Group, taking care of P-47 Thunderbolts in the Pacific.
I could see the size of the blip and know approximately how many aircraft were coming and how far away they were. And they had the big maps on the floor. Mm-hmm. So we were being trained in that. And so that's how come they just put us with the Air Force. We had to have airplanes. And we had the big P-47s. It was a fighter and also a pursuit plane.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how I got hurt. In order for us to go in and bomb Japan, you had to have that extra gasoline. So to get up there, come back. One day, my assignment was to go down the beach and get all these things off of the boat so that they're ready to go add on to the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
To come down a dirty road, and this was the road that Amy Powell was killed on.
Right, so this is the tiny little island of Aoshima right off
Okinawa.
And Ernie Pyle, the famous American
war
journalist, was
killed there.
A sniper got him on this road.
Yeah.
So everybody's afraid to travel this road.
Yeah, my relief was supposed to show up, but I know he got cold feet. He didn't want to come down that road and maybe get picked off because they were hiding in the things, you know.
So you're still there, and all these belly tanks for P-47s are stacked up?
Yeah.
But because your replacement didn't come, you're a little sleepy and you took a nap on top of one of them?
Yeah. And I was told, you know, the officer said, George, you know, your relief hasn't shown up. Go ahead, take a little nap. Well, he moved a few more rows, you know. Now all of a sudden, they're bombing us. I want to get off the boat. What do you think they're trying to do is knock out the boat, right?
Well, so because you're asleep, and then the air raid siren goes off, so you wake up, you say, I got to get out of here, I'm going to die. You go to run, but the bombs that were stacked in front of the one you're on are gone.
That's right.
So you fall how far?
15 or 20 feet, but when I hit the bottom, I hit the side of my face. So there was I forgot the word we used, they were medics. That's medics.
Corpsmen?
Yeah, so I went down, I knew there was one down maybe 15 or 20 yards away. And I said, you know, I just fell off the boat, and I said, I feel a little dizzy. And he said, well, you got to get yourself x-rayed. He says, your face is all swollen, you know. I hit the side of my head. He says, you just go up there, follow that rope line. There's the field hospital, and they'll take care of you. They'll x-ray you and everything. So that night, a direct hit was made on a Marine barrack. It killed about 25, and all of a sudden, the ones that survived were in the same field section I was in, and they wanted to get out. They fished that pilot out, the Japanese pilot. He was a little guy, and they tried to crawl out of the thing to kill him. Mm-hmm. I mean, when they dragged him in, I felt sorry, even though I got hurt. I did have a feeling for the poor little guy. I don't know if he lived or died.
Mm.
But they dragged him back and put him back, and I know the Marines were trying to crawl out of their cots to get at him, you know?
Yeah.
I can't blame them, but, you know, war is war.
They just lost 20 of their buddies.
Yeah.
So for you, your face is hurt and your shoulders hurt.
Yeah.
So the medical staff looks at you and they wanted to give you a Purple Heart, right?
Yeah. I didn't want, I says, how am I going to explain I fell off the boat?
Uh-huh.
I don't want anything to do with it. I said, I'm all right. And I know I did hurt my arm. My arm was never as good anymore, but it was still good enough. I had an outstanding throwing arm, but it was good enough that I could play.
After that incident, though, yeah. It was never the same.
No.
But George Genovese's love for the game would prove much more powerful than that World War II injury. More of his story from during and after the war when we come back. Check out the photos and video on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And plan on meeting George and author Dan Taylor at their book signing in Fresno, California on July 11th. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.